I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on The Times radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to The Ruck. This is a Slot and Jones special, the reason being all the other journalists have gone to bed. Lightweights. Jonesy, alas, Slot and Jones. Or is it a case of, alas, England?
Yeah, very much so. We just come down from Bloemfontein to Durban on the semi-high veld, and it was grim. I mean, if you're an English rugby fan, the atmosphere was grim up there. Not too good before the game or during the game, but after the game, I think fans and the team themselves and the management and the media are very, very downcast because they're on a really bad run. And actually, the second test, they were way inferior to the first test. It's going downhill at the moment.
So for me, quite clearly, this is the lowest ebb of England since that World Cup disaster in 2015. No, I mean, it feels to me a bit like that. So someone pointed out that it felt a bit like Clive Woodward's Lions in 2005, when you're away on the trip and you can see it sliding away and you don't feel there's any way of getting it back.
No, they're very true. The thing is with the Lions, it's very, very difficult, and it's a totally different thing. I mean, even the three test series against South Africa, when there's no jet lag, there's no time difference, and there's just three games, no midweek, it is much easier than the Lions to, although the way the box are playing, nothing's easy about it. But actually, they've lost 2-0, never looked like winning either game, in my opinion, and now you've got this rather, not silly, but you've got this sort of consolation prize, which is not really a consolation prize coming up. And for all their hopes that they were going to win the Six Nations, they were going to win in Australia, win in South Africa, then they were going to steam through and be number one in the world to the World Cup, really that's all gone by the board now, and they're scrabbling to get any sort of respectability at all.
This podcast has started on a bit of a negative. Have we missed the fact that John Spencer bought us a bottle of wine last night, the RFU president?
Well, he probably charged it. It has started on a bit of a negative, but in terms of our careers, don't forget, recently for the first time ever, I've written for The Times, The Thunderer, and you've written for The Sunday Times. And neither of us ever done that before, and I consider it a great honour to have you in my paper and to be in your paper.
Well, apparently sales of The Sunday Times were flying through the roof today on the back of this new byline, but I didn't get a picture like you did in The Times.
Well, they wouldn't put your picture in, would they? But it's the other thing is, do we get any money, more money for that, or is it still the same?
I like where you're going with this conversation. That is one of those questions that you ask when you know the answer, isn't it? You said that there was really very little to take from England, and all the promises that Eddie had made and the hopes that England had for the building of this team seemed to be evaporating before our eyes. Question I get asked a lot is it gone? Is the World Cup vanishing as we watch this team imploding?
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, unless they change direction in a massive way, and by that I mean Eddie especially, it's you can forget the World Cup. They've really got to say to themselves, guys, we started off well in the Eddie Jones era, then it started going horribly wrong, and now we're really at the bottom, and they've got to take steps to almost start again. And I think that the autumn is a new start. I think Eddie, first of all, ought to cut the number of people he keeps on choosing, just have a tight squad, much older squad, much more experienced squad, much bigger squad, much more physical squad. Stop mucking around with all these kids that he keeps on drafting in from the under-20s and start off by there with a serious squad, bearing in mind that the World Cup's always won by experienced teams. And 03, for instance, we keep on going back to, was a massively experienced team with about 12 leaders in 15 positions. That is what he's got to aim at. Now, I just said in the paper this morning, sorry, yesterday morning, it'll be by the time our darling listeners are listening to this, Eddie's got to change himself. He's got too uptight. He's got too affected. He's not looking after discipline. He is having far too many sessions. He is fretting too much. He's bringing in too many gurus like the brain professor. He's now on his third attack coach, I think. He'll be bringing in his new farming coach next. So then his toenail correspondent. There are too many people involved in it. Calm down, Eddie. Go to bed. Have a nice sleep. And let's prepare this team properly.
Steve, I read your piece to which you're referring, and I thought it was bang on, apart from one point. All your suggestions were irrelevant because Eddie won't change. This is the problem with the man, and I think that's why the spiral is so hard to get out of, because he spends all hours of the day, he gets up at 4 a.m. or whatever, trying to work out what's wrong with everything else, and he does not look in the mirror to see what he sees there. He's got this guy, Neil Craig. Have you seen this guy?
No.
He's an Australian, like most of his staff are. He's a hugely decorated coach from the AFL, Aussie Football League, Aussie Rules. And he's been brought in, paid lots of money, no doubt, to watch Eddie and tell Eddie how he could be improving. And pretty much since the day that he's been here, it's been going wrong.
Doesn't that strike you as rather bonkers, Owen?
Yeah, but it fits in with what you say. I mean, where's the toenail correspondent? Where's the farming correspondent? All this stuff is going on, and they're making the whole business of creating a world-beating rugby team so complicated, where what England need at the moment is simplification.
I totally agree. But doesn't it strike you as well that when you're bringing in all these people, they're sort of almost crutches for you to keep yourself up on? I mean, it strikes me that with all these people coming in, Eddie is not nearly as self-confident as we think he is, and he would like to have us believe. And, you know, when you say he doesn't change, coaching, surely the art of coaching is when it's going wrong, you've got to change. You can't keep on saying, well, I've done this since 1981 and I'm going to do the same again. And look, the players, in my mind, are definitely going out with their heads full of rubbish and clutter. They're not focused. Their morale is not very good, even though individually they try hard. And Eddie's got to change. Now, I said in the paper that Eddie is still the man to do it. But if he doesn't change, I'm afraid by the time we come to the autumn, people are going to start changing their minds, because they can't have a bad autumn. If they do, then he's really struggling.
I agree with you on the Eddie front, but the quality of the England team, if you get the best England team out there, I'm still of the opinion that they are top four in the world easy, probably or arguably the second best team in the world. Whether they could beat the All Blacks here in a World Cup final, that's another matter altogether. So I still think that England have the quality. You could put together a team that could challenge.
Slotty, you and I usually see eye to eye. I totally disagree with that. It seems like you're buying into this ludicrous excuse that Eddie says that, oh, don't forget, we've got 26 players at home, and everyone's trying to think who the players are who are going to come into this team.
I'm not thinking that.
No, okay, well, you name the players that are going to make the team that is fifth in the Tri-Nations, and fifth in the Six Nations, and is probably going to go down 3-0 to South Africa. Name me the players that are going to make them second best in the world.
Well, I'll start off with the fact that the bulk of the Lions team that drew with the All Blacks were English. Mako, Jamie George, Marrow, you would have had Billy in there if he'd been fit. Owen Farrell and Elliot Daly, that's six, before you've even started. Ben Youngs was invited on that tour, probably luckily didn't go. But that's just your start.
All those players you just mentioned have been in the team which collapsed in the last two weekends. They didn't happen for them.
Yeah, that's pretty much my point. That these were players who performed for the Lions, and less than a month ago, most of the players I just named performed brilliantly for Saracens. We came here to South Africa thinking, wow, these Saracens players are on cracking form, but they come into the England setup and they play worse. Now, that's a failure of coaching.
Totally. Sorry, I do apologise. I see exactly what you mean, and it's frightening because, you know, as you say, these guys in the Saracens jersey, and also some of the other club players, like Elliot Daly in the Wasps jersey, it's just absolutely sensational. And, you know, yet for the third season in a row, the best team in England, including the national team, has undoubtedly been Saracens. And it is frightening. And I think it's Eddie feeding far too much information. Now, you know, when we go and see Saracens play and when we listen to Mark McCall afterwards, he's very terse, he doesn't give much away, he's incredibly focused. People clearly love playing for them. They really love coaching in the group. They really love Sarries. They go all over the world with them and they love what they're doing. I don't get the impression at the moment that any of this England team is enjoying it.
Okay, so Steve, England are 2-0 down. As you say, there's a consolation prize to be won out there. I think it's a bit more than a consolation prize, because if you're going back to England on 3-0 down, six test defeats in a row, then the cycle appears to perpetuate. If they come back with a little bit of a spring in their step, then it's not so bad, clearly. What changes would you make for the third test? Let's go straight for the juggler. Number 10, do you stick with George Ford?
No, of course you don't. Everybody knows who the number 10 should be. And I would hope that Eddie Jones promised Danny Cipriani a test before they left the shores. Ben Youngs was really in a poor way at the end. And I think George, under all that pressure, I think he caved in a bit. I think it's got to be Danny Cipriani and Dan Robson. They deserve the chance. England got nothing to lose. I'd also give Alice Lazowski a go in the centre, outside Owen Farrell. I don't think that... Henry Clay's done badly at all, but I think they just give Lazowski a go. I would also, you've got to beef up this pack, you have to. Harry Williams to start on the tight head, and Maro Itoje, I'm sorry, but I would put Maro in the back row. They've got to bulk up this pack. And I put Johnny Hill, who's a big and a clever lad, I put him in the second row with Joe Launchbury. I'm sorry, Brad Shields didn't do it for me. I thought he was ponderous. So at least you get some sort of beef there. Nathan Hughes for Billy Vunipola at number 8. And poor old Billy's off out again. But there's not much room for manoeuvre, but you need an extra big man in the pack. And it's time that Danny was given the baton to conduct the orchestra.
I'm completely and utterly agreeing with you on the Danny front and on Dan Robson. But has Eddie not created a big problem for himself here? As in... If it works, and Danny Cipriani gives us incontrovertible evidence that he is the man, then one, Eddie looks foolish because he's missed out. He spent 2.5 years backing the wrong man. Two, he then has the big decision, do I carry on with him from here on in, or do I go back to what I've known and loved all that time? He's creating a rod for his back. A big coach has to do that nevertheless, surely.
Yeah, of course he does. But, I mean, he's made so many rods for his back, he can't have any back left. I mean, he's made rods for his back with selection, preparation and everything. And the question is, you know, George Ford is by no means a bad player, but I think that, you know, Danny deserves the chance. Now, I'm afraid, if you put someone in and you're afraid of them playing well because it makes you look like a fool, well, you're a double fool. I mean, all Eddie wants to do, surely, is to make... England win this game and give them a spot of spark and electricity with Danny. If it comes off brilliantly, he can throw it up his hands and say, well, maybe I didn't get it wrong all that time, but Danny's now the man, and off you go. You know, if you, what you're saying is, and I know exactly why you're saying it, you know, it looks embarrassing if you change your team after all this time, but he's got to do it with Robshaw, he's got to do it with Ben Youngs, he's got to do it with Mike Brown, so it's just one of those things.
Okay, can we try and put England's problems into context? As when we arrived here, England were a team that had some stature, albeit that it was crumbling. And South Africa, we didn't know what to expect, but they'd come off probably their two worst seasons since they came out of isolation. In the short space of two games, England have nosedived and South Africa have risen beautifully and wonderfully, and it's been a real privilege, I think we both agree, to witness. But actually, how good were they?
Very good question. And I think, first of all, they have been down in the dumps. They've been terrible. But Razi Erasmus has come in. He's done two things. First of all, he's told the South African Rugby Union where to go with their stupid policy of not picking overseas players when you've got 80 professional players out there. Dwayne Vermeulen, Willie LaRue, absolutely magical. Faf de Klerk, also magical. Immediately now they've marched into the World 15 of the moment. So
and he's got a couple more to come back in.
Yes.
Bismarck Duplessis would have started the last two tests. I mean, there are more that he can draw on, and it's For me, it's just shown the inspirational effect of one or two major players coming in, which, to hark back, was kind of what Eddie was hoping from Brad Shields.
Yeah, but he didn't get. I think Willie LaRue was always a great player and just needed to come out of himself, but Brad Shields probably not so, although it is early for that. But just the other thing I was going to say was Razzy Erasmus, instead of mucking around bringing in loads of coaches and brain professors and all that sort of thing, he's got down there, he's appealed clearly to their hearts, he's bought into the transformation thing, he's been simple, and he's returned the box back to a power game. Now, it, not only a power game, because they did play some delightful rugby, but the pack is beasting people like it should, like it did, even without three of the front five. And I think Razzy's come in, and he's looked people in the eye and said, no mucking around, no gurus, just get back to being box. And to be honest with you, in a year's time, they could be really good.
So for me, that's interesting what you just said about the beasting box, absolutely correct. When Eddie arrived, and I've written this in the paper tomorrow, when Eddie arrived, he said, we're going to build England on their traditional strengths, which is defence, really good set piece, and a scary bunch of forwards. And what we've seen on this tour is some magnificent back play or fleeting glimpses of it, but up front, absolute shockingly nothing. A maul that can't drive forwards and a scrum that goes backwards.
The maul, to be honest with you, I found humiliating for them, because they are meant to be a mauling team. Whenever they went for the maul, put the ball into touch, you think, no, boys, don't do that. Just have a scrum and give it to the backs, because the maul was humiliating. South Africa just murdered it. So, you know, he's gone back. Honestly, he's gone back on his promises. If you haven't got the raw material, you can't do anything about it. But the truth is, he left Dan Cole at home, for instance, in the scrum, thinking that maybe out of Harry Williams and Carl Sinclair and putting the pack together, he would get a really good scrum. Well, he hasn't, and it looks like, actually, by not being here, Dan Cole has done more to keep his place than if he was here. And, you know, it worries me, because I can't see. The development process is not that great. I can't see. Can you see any great big beasts, a Martin Johnson or a Jason Leonard or a Phil Vickery on the sidelines anywhere or in the younger teams?
You know, unproven. But the player that I most wanted to come on tour that didn't, I know yours is Don Armand, and I'd love to have seen him here. The player that I most wanted to come on tour was Nick Shonnott, the Worcester Warriors tight head, and. God, we could have done with a proper tight head to scrummage for the first part of the games. I am a huge fan of Kyle Sinclair, but he's proven so far on this tour, and he did in the Six Nations as well, that he's great at the finish. He ain't good at the start.
Do you know what? I think Nick Shonnott has joined one of those people, those groups of, which include Don Armand and Danny Cipriani, that actually the more we talk about them, the less likely Eddie seems to pick them. I think Shonnott is massively rated at Worcester. The people who play Worcester say he's good. He's a great big foundation stone, and to not have him here was just don't get it. That's a good start to what you say as a new pack, but you still need more. Jamie George has been reasonable at hooker, but not a massive guy. Surely they can't go back to Dylan Hartley. Mako Vunipola looks absolutely exhausted. But again, if you're going to play Maro Toji in the second row, where is the big beast next to him? It's not Joe Launchbury. Courtney Lords is now a real lightweight. He can't put weight on. They must go out and get a Dave Atwood type figure.
He must be.
I think he's the man. So sorry, you just said who are the big bruisers that aren't here? Well, Shonnott, I mentioned, and Atwood, who I know you're in love with Atwood, and I think he's magnificent as well. And he finished the Toulon season really well. He'll be under Eddie's nose in Bath the next season, and he's got to come in.
Well, he's got to. You know, I was in love with him, but not anymore, because Mrs. Atwood was objected to it. She didn't like it at all. But look, he's a big beast. He's good enough for Toulon, and they just have forward dominated teams. He's good enough for them. And I think Dave Atwood has had a problem, because he's been discarded so many times by England. I think he lost a bit of confidence, but I think he's found it again in the south of France. And again, if I can get two big beasts, I put someone like Courtney Laws or Maro Toji in the back row, just so you have a third man, a third lineup man, a third option, and a third big bugger.
Steve, you've been a little bit ageist on this podcast so far. You don't like young people, which is fair enough. Can you make an exception, or would you make an exception for the kid who I think should stay, even though he's not really proven it yet, for Tom Curry at seven? Because I don't honestly see a better answer there yet. And I feel slightly sorry for Eddie in that front, because he's tried a number of people and they keep on getting injured. Whose fault that is another matter altogether. But I think Tom Curry's been decent enough and they should persevere with him.
No, I don't. No, look, I think he's been decent and he's stayed on till the end. He's been really lively. But has he really been anything more than on the frippery of these massive
boosts?
But you see, the thing is, it comes to a time when you've got to stop looking for someone who's not there. You've got to stop looking for the true open side. Now, I think the nearest they got is Gary Graham and Newcastle Falcons, who had a fantastic game against Leicester Tigers last year. He's the nearest one they got. He should have been on this tour. But if you haven't got one, you've got to pick three big beasts, and instead of scrabbling for the ball, you just got to smash over it. And I think Eddie's now at that stage, whether it's Nathan Hughes or if James Haskell can get fit, truly fit again, whether it's him. The last time they had a good man wearing the seven jersey was Haskell 2 or 3 years ago in Australia. And I think Tom Curry might get there, but he's tall and lean. He's not powerful. And I think not yet for Tom.
If you're on a Haskell type, then it isn't your man Brad Shields just there? He does what Haskell does. He's just 5 years younger.
I'm yet to be convinced. I don't know what you thought of him or how many marks you gave him out of 10, Owen. But
seven.
You give him seven. I give him six or five, I think. Because there was that time when he burst away. You think, come on, mate, you're in the clear here. And he did this sort of thinking he was David Campese, but at the age of 96. Look. Someone must rate him somewhere, but he's 27. He's never played for the All Blacks till then. Let's see how he goes. No doubt he's tired after the season, but let's see how he goes with Wasps. But I think he needs to lose weight and get fitter. Then we'll see. At this time, I don't see him being better than James Haskell when Haskell is at his best.
Steve, we just touched upon what a privilege it has been to be here in South Africa. What has absolutely stood out for you in these last two tests?
Well, first of all, they call it transformation now. And what stood out for me, I've been to South Africa loads of times, and I get the impression in the country and in the team and in the stadiums that people are now buying into transformation and the idea of a team with plenty of players of colour. And I think it was typified yesterday when the Beast brought on his children, one on each shoulder, a little boy, a little girl, to mark his 100th cap. And they both had little Springbok jerseys with Beast written on it. And the reception he got in Bloemfontein was something, because it's very much an Africana farming area. That was a great moment. And to see Sia Kolisi and the Beast singing the anthem, roaring it out, like the Pumas used to, you know, was just fantastic.
It sort of fuels the team as well, don't you think? I mean, they're feeding off it, so the crowd feed off those sort of moments, like you say, Kolisi and Matawira singing together, and it felt emotional, and then the crowd love it, and then they give it back to the players, and the players are inspired. I kind of feel there's a momentum thing there. But would you say that was actually the musical highlight of the Test match yesterday, or did you quite like that the pre-match entertainment was of a kind?
Do you know what? We're in South Africa, the country of Johnny Clegg, Miriam Makeba, Ladysmith Black Mambazo, Sifo Mabuse, and the unbelievable number of great rock bands which came out of Soweto and the township rock. It's called Makeba, the township rock music. Absolutely magnificent. What did we get yesterday? We got Survivor, The Eye of the Tiger, We Are the Champions, what was that, Brianna?
Brian Adams.
Brian Adams, he's about 150. And just the awful mid-Atlantic banging crap.
But Steve, I saw you tapping your toes to Wham. I mean, you appeared to be enjoying that.
No, I wasn't. I was banging my laptop with my head. It was shocking. Do you know, it's ear-splitting, but actually someone sitting not far from me, actually holding the microphone, claimed to like the stuff where there's a break in play when they go for a scrum and there's ear-splitting American crap played there and then while you're waiting for the next play, and you said you liked it.
No, let's be clear. You're libelling me there.
No,
that's just, that is not feasible. I was so busy with my head in my laptop trying to file a piece for your newspaper, I possibly couldn't have done that.
You needed to polish it a bit, obviously. But you said you liked that music. Why do you have to fill every microsecond between 10 a.m. and the end of the game with head-banging music, especially when you've got delightful South African artists? And just for our listeners, Slotty did say he liked those interpolations where you have "We Are the Champions" played.
Sorry, I'm taking the microphone away from you, Steve. This is now a one-man show. While you've been tapping your toes to Wham, Steve, and England have been going backwards, there's been a lot of other decent rugby going on around the world. Ireland are now 1-1 in a really, really gripping series with Australia, which I think is the best rugby I've seen of this summer so far. Wales are now 2-0 up on Argentina. France are 2-0 down to the All Blacks, but I think we've seen quite a lot from France to suggest that there's something happening there. It seems to me that while England in this slow and steady implosion, that almost every other nation is really doing something.
I totally agree, and it's so exciting for the World Cup. Oh, incidentally, you did say that about the music. It is fantastically exciting. Australia, South Africa, Wales, Ireland coming forward, and blimey, you know, USA have just won their first ever game against a tier one nation, against Scotland, which is just fantastic. Ireland, you know, surely that was an object lesson to England. You go 1-0 down. Make a few changes, you gear yourself up in the right areas, you eliminate the mistakes you made in the first test, and you come out and you put Australia to the sword. I thought it was a classic comeback game, and suggest to me, as we said a few weeks ago, Ireland are very, very much in the mix of that top four at the top end of the World Cup.
Again, that's another huge slight on Eddie Jones, isn't it? You have an England who underperformed in Ellis Park, but knew if they got things right, then they could do it the second time round. But actually, as you said, they were worse second time round. Again, it's just a failure of coaching.
A failure of coaching, but you know, also performance too. But you know, as you said, they're only one game away from being back on the road. And the way they came out onto the field and sang the anthem, oh God, they are so up for it. But they sank. There was no passion and electricity throughout the second half. Whereas Ireland came out full of almost murderous intent.
Something we haven't touched upon is leadership and captaincy. I wrote a very learned column during last week when I said I thought Owen was the right captain, but he's got quite a lot of improving to do to get there. Having seen that second test, I'm slightly doubting that opinion. It was severely tested. He had a poor, poor game as captain. So, question, do you A, stick with Owen and think he's going to have to learn and he's the man? Do you B, go home, presume Dylan's going to be fit again and go back to what we knew and questioned for so long? Or do you go somewhere else altogether?
Well, let's say, first of all, you know, it wasn't the captain of the Titanic's fault whether it's an iceberg. And it's, you know, if there's a hole in your boat, you're struggling. I do think that probably, you know, why would you give Dylan 50-odd games and Owen Farrell just two? I think if you've got to stick with him and back with him and back him. But I do think, Owen, I'm sure you agree, it's not so much the captain on his own, but it's just a failure of leadership throughout the team. I just do not see leaders. I do not see people getting everyone around. I think Maro Itoje, he's trying. He's been forced to be a leader, and he's doing his best. I think it's put him off his game. I think he's become indisciplined. But, you know, I wish I could say that, you know, yesterday that, you know, Joe Launchbury, Brad Shields, Billy Vunipola, Nathan Hughes, I wish I could say that they look like leaders, or I could see them through the binoculars doing some sort of leadership duty, but I didn't. And this team lacks leaders, and it doesn't matter who's captain. If you're the only voice out there, you're not going to get very far.
Why should it be the case that this generation has come through rudderless in this respect? It's not just, you could say, oh, because English players are all developed in academies now, so they're all they lose their personality, but that's the same with professional rugby players across the globe. It's no different in England to anywhere else.
I think that's an interesting point. I think England's academies are just that little bit more sort of anodyne, lacking sort of warmth and humanity. I think that Irish and Welsh academies, the ones I've seen, do have a little bit more of a, you know, let's leave it to the players. You know, you work this out. You sort this out. You be a leader. And I think, you know, you said, well, it's got to be more than the academies in England just coming, bringing out, pushing out gym monkeys and, you know, people who can know the playbook off by heart. But I think there's a lot of truth in that. And I think somewhere you've got to go back to basics and give people the chance to make up their own minds and be their own leaders. You can't tell someone to be a leader. You can't bring in a professor of brain power and to get people to be a leader. It's innate. But it's got to start being innate when they go into these academies at 15 and 16.
Steve, Wales have gone to Argentina with a mixed team, to say the least. They've won two test matches pretty convincingly. They're coming back with strength and depth. Again, they seem to have done the things that England wanted.
Yeah, they have. I mean, I think England wanted to try and win, whereas I think actually Warren Gatland just wanted to develop his squad and fill out his squad. I think probably he thought, well, we're not going to win every game. For a start, let's point out to everybody back at home that we don't actually see these games because they take place about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning in South Africa. I haven't actually seen a lot of them at all, just some highlights. But I had no idea what's happened to the Pumas. But Wales are so denuded of players. It is a famous triumph for them to be, you know, to play 3-1-3. Absolutely tremendous. And I think they got some props coming through, which is absolutely vital. And then when you go back, you add Warburton, you know, Alan Wynne-Jones and these guys, Dan Bigger. Jonathan Davis come back in. I just think that Warren Gatland, for everything he gets wrong, he does get World Cups right. And I think they're really looking at having a great squad. Can they get over? The thing is, can they get over this awful hurdle of the autumn where they're always terrible? If they get through that, then they're contenders, just like Ireland, for the semi-finals.
Do you think Gatland might have been enjoying a little bit England's travails in South Africa?
I tell you what, he's not a bitter guy. He wouldn't go around sort of attacking people and attacking members of the crowd and all that sort of thing. So, no, I think he'll be... Warren knows the English players and likes them. And they took him to a great result in New Zealand. So I think he'd probably be miffed for some of them. But not probably for the Red Rose itself.
That is nearly the end of a famous and a novel, two-handed edition of The Ruck. Let's just finish off with some predictions. England... against South Africa, third test, the dead rubber. How would you call that?
I'd call it this way. If Razzie Erasmus really wants to rub England's noses in it and picks their top team and really winds them up, they could really put England away. Luckily for England, I think that he will make changes, give other people a go, bring Andre Oosterhuizen into the centre, who I think is going to be a better player than the ones they've got. Maybe give the beast a rest and start Steve Kitshoff. But I think that I just don't see where England now, denuded by with the loss of Billy Vunipola, could possibly turn the tide, because the tide is now really swamping them.
I've said the last 2 weeks I thought England would win it. I've said both times they have the quality, and if they have the personality, then they can pull it out of the bag and do it. I'm not going to say it again. I think South Africa will win that, and I think they'll win it more convincingly than they did yesterday.
Yeah, so do I. But I would just like, look, people say we're down on England. We just want them to do well and to win. And I just felt sorry for the team yesterday and for Eddie, because they just look so distraught and everything. I do feel sorry for them, and I think they deserve a lift in terms of their morale, not in terms of their class, because I don't think they're a very classy team. But with Cipriani there, and he must be there, maybe he'll give them a lift, because someone needs to.
I think there is a misconception amongst some of the public that when England start imploding like this and the media have to write about it, that we get some kind of a sordid pleasure out of it, that we kind of enjoy it. So should we just knock that on the head? The greatest pleasure you get from covering the England team, even if you're not English born or bred or whatever, is when you see a success, because it is a real privilege to write about. And this is no fun.
No, it's not fun at all. You have to be honest with what you think, because when you stop being honest, as you know, you've had it. You've got to give up. And we're not fans, and we're not fans with typewriters or keyboards, but you do want them to win. It gives you a glow. I mean, I never felt so bad, so good in my life as when England won the World Cup. Not because I was biased, but because we grew up with those players, and we've grown up with these as well, even though we're now a different age group. And actually, Eddie Jones is a very colourful man. Paul Gustard's a nice man. Steve Borthwick, I'm sure, is a nice man. And you just want them to do well and put English rugby on the map. And all our kids at home, and all the kids that I've coached, and all the kids we know, and all the families, and all the rugby lovers, and all the volunteers, we want their team to be up there.
And they're saying to us, I'm sure they're saying to you as well, they're saying, what's happened? Why has it gone wrong? What's the problem? And it's so goddamn hard to answer. But the point is, we'd much rather it went right. And on that positive note, Steve, thanks very much. Thank you to all our listeners for following the Ruck. This is the second of three specials out here in South Africa. There will be one more following the third test next weekend. Thank you for tuning in. Please come back again next week.
Mother's Day is just around the corner, and it's time to pamper the special moms in your life. And what better way than with Osea's limited edition skincare sets featuring clean, vegan, cruelty-free products that are safe for your skin and the planet. Osea is a women-founded, women-led brand that's been making seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. This Mother's Day, Osea has two limited edition sets, perfect for gifting or keeping for yourself. Their Golden Glow body set includes three clinically proven bestsellers for silky, smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go Facial set has everything she needs to achieve spa-level results at home. They're so beautiful, you can skip the wrapping. For a limited time, you can save up to $48 on Osea sets, plus get free shipping. That's Mother's Day made easy. Pamper the moms in your life and get 10% off your first order site-wide with code MOM at OseaMalibu.com. That's OseaMalibu.com, code MOM.